Coming up on another exciting installment of That Was a Show.
Hey, have you guys seen Sports Night?
Oh, is that the old Sorkin sitcom?
Yeah.
No, I haven't seen it.
Nope.
Happy 2021, everybody. This is the first episode we're recording in 2021. Thank you all so much for listening. If you've been listening for a while, thank you so much for supporting the show. We've received such great feedback during our first year, and we really appreciate it. And if you're joining us for the first time, welcome!
We'd like to kick off this new year with an audience appeal. Podcasts like ours, the ones without a huge advertising budget, spread mostly through word of mouth. If you enjoy the show, it would help us out a lot if you could tell a couple of your friends about it. Everyone knows at least a couple of people who like both podcasts and TV comedy, so if you tell a couple of those people, it would really help us out. Hound those people until they listen. Just keep nagging until it gets awkward. Or, I don't know, maybe that's a bad idea. You know what? Use your judgment on that one.
The other thing you can do that's even easier is to subscribe, if you haven't already. In Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, or whatever platform you like, subscribing will deliver our latest episodes to your phone or whatever as soon as we release it. That doesn't mean you need to listen right away. I personally subscribe to at least 10 podcasts, and I often have a backlog of episodes to catch up on later. But it really helps with all the magic algorithms and helps people discover the podcast. And if you really like it, don't forget to rate and review too. So that's all for now. Enjoy episode 18.
18, oh my god.
Cold open. We grew up during peak sitcom, Seinfeld, Friends, The Fresh Prince. But those shows were diamonds in the rough. This podcast is not about those diamonds. It's about the rough. Some sitcoms were briefly popular in their time. Some were canceled almost immediately. You probably won't recognize most of these, and you'll ask, that was a show?
That was a show?
The podcast about failed or forgotten sitcoms from the 80s and 90s, starring
Bryn Burney,
Aaron Yeager,
and Andrew Helmer as Barry.
A Radio Gizmo production.
Yeah, so Barry, why don't you go ahead and tell us about Sports Night?
Thanks. I'll be honest with you guys. I was really excited for this one. I mean, I ended up picking it just because I couldn't think of anything else, but this show Sports Night is something that I always think of when I think of failed or forgotten shows. It's had a long-lasting cultural impact, but it was a complete failure. Sports Night was an ABC sitcom that centered on the personal and professional lives of the on- and off-air talent of a nightly live cable sports program. It starred Peter Krause and Josh Charles as news anchor writing partners Casey McCall and Dan Rydell, Felicity Huffman as powerhouse producer Dana, Sabrina Lloyd as her loyal associate producer Natalie, Joshua Molina as a quirky analyst named Jeremy, and Robert Guillaume as the show's out-of-retirement managing editor Isaac Jaffe. Sports Night aired for two seasons, from September 1998 till May of 2000. It was the first network series created by Hollywood mainstay Aaron Sorkin, who also wrote more than the lion's share of episodes as well. It was the first of three series that Sorkin created that centered around the backstage workings of a television program, followed by Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip in 2006 and The Newsroom in 2012. We watched two episodes, the pilot and the third episode of season two. In the pilot, we're introduced to the workings of the series as lead anchor Casey's on and off-air performance spirals downwards after a disastrous divorce. As his best friend and partner Dan tries to get him back on his game by inspiring him with tales of his New York epiphany, producer Dana butts heads with both her boss and the network executives who are gunning to fire Casey for his lackluster delivery and off-air belligerence. Later, in the third episode of the second season, entitled Cliff Gardner, new reoccurring guest star William H. Macy's Sam Donovan battles not only Hoffman's Dana, but also the cast, crew, and network executives as he's brought on as a ratings consultant to stir things up. The stark difference between these episodes is ridiculous, and it's the reason why I chose both. While the first season, despite having moments of drama, has all the trappings of a workplace sitcom, including an off-putting laugh track. By the second season, the series had settled into full-on drama, shoved really painfully into a sitcom's struggling body. The laugh track is completely gone, the jokes are lessened, and the stakes are more intense. The series, like I said, is very interesting in that while it is certainly a failure, it is not forgotten. It endures to this day with a cult following, and obviously everything Sorkin is involved with picks up some form of audience. That was Sports Night.
That was a really good intro.
Thanks, guys.
Very detailed.
I'm going to say right off the bat, the visual style of this show is not what I would expect for comedy. And when I say that, I do not mean the lighting. Like, I'm cool with the kind of more dramatic lighting and the whole single cam thing. But there's a lot of tight over the shoulder shots and framings of singles that just immediately scream drama. Even though the cadence of the dialogue in the pilot and the laugh track are clearly packaging it as a comedy.
So Sorkin here works with his longtime director partner, Thomas Schlemm.
Yeah.
And they have like a really cohesive like visual language that even from right back in 98, you could see that like, because this was, I believe, would have been their first collaboration. And you can see that right off the bat, it is different than anything else on television. Like it doesn't look, sound, or feel like anything on TV. And that's definitely why it failed.
Okay. I mean, that's true. But I feel like there's something off about it. There's definitely something that they should have kind of eased into that format. It might have been too jarring for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think right off the bat, I would imagine an audience first reaction to this show to just be like, what? Because this, let's put it this way. This show was paired with Home Improvement and The Drew Carey Show.
Wow.
Yeah. So very boilerplate sitcoms. Yeah. It's kind of like sandwiched in there with it.
So they were clearly trying to position it as a sitcom.
Yeah.
It's a sitcom in that it was sold as a sitcom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not.
That's what I'm wondering about. Like, where was that pivot? Like, where did that happen? Like, was it something in, like, at the time, maybe Sorkin had no clout in the, you know, 1 hour drama world, and his only contact was somebody at comedy, and so they pitched it as a comedy, but really it wasn't a comedy? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
like, where did that, because it, you know, to me, this reminded me a lot of our discussion of Townies. Because, you know, we had that theory that Townies could have been good as a 1 hour drama.
Yep.
It's the same kind of deal, don't you think?
Yeah.
They had to pitch it as a sitcom for some reason.
It's interesting because I actually know the reasons behind that.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. Please enlighten us.
So essentially, it was a script idea that Sorkin was kicking around for a feature. And this should come as no surprise. He could not get the story beats to work as a feature. It just didn't work.
Right.
And the only way he thought that the idea itself made sense was episodically, right?
Sure.
And right now, yeah, and there wasn't a lot of... nobody was buying different dramas. It was 1998, you know.
Right, it was all procedurals.
We were a year away from The Sopranos and a year away from The West Wing, which also would go on and change things, right? And also, like, when the show got canceled in 2000, multiple cable networks offered to buy it and potentially retool it as a drama.
Oh.
And Sorkin turned them all down.
Really?
Mm. Yeah.
Why?
Well, because he was already working on The West Wing.
Okay, that makes sense.
I mean, full disclosure, I have for years always wondered, there tends to be a pretty rigid distinction between the idea that a half-hour series is comedy and a one-hour series is drama, and why aren't there more half-hour dramas or one-hour comedies? It was always something that I've wondered for years. I like the idea of them trying to fit this kind of dramatic premise into a half-hour show. It's just that there's also a laugh track and
some really awkward laugh track
and selected scenes, not every scene across the board, but selected scenes that have jokes and dialogue that is of a sitcom world, but it's not consistently like that.
You guys know that I very seldom take notes when I'm doing this.
Yeah.
I wrote down one word and it was just titters.
Yes, it was like a weak laugh track because they're like, well, they can't laugh too hard because it's not that funny. It's just like, witty.
There are so many little moments of titters.
Yeah.
Where
they're
delayed.
Trying to gauge what people's actual reaction to it would be.
Almost like, hey, would you guys laugh to this? Maybe.
No, come on. No. It was for the scenes where there is a laugh track. It was shot in front of an audience,
oh,
which is
my
funny.
God.
Really?
That it is a fucking single camera show.
Oh, it's
right?
So weird.
Yeah.
Oh, that's weird.
And it was ABC panicked, right?
Yeah.
They really, really panicked. And I think I read a quote, I think it was Josh Molina was talking about it, where like somebody literally had said, how will they know when it's funny?
Oh my God. Oh my God.
That's great.
And the reason I really wanted to choose an episode in the second season, not only just so you guys could see William H. Macy being William H. Macy,
yeah,
but also is to show that, honestly, like, they relaxed on all of that over the
yes.
course of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
the laugh
is
track is gone.
Yeah.
And also, they're not even really trying to be all that funny anymore
no.
by the second
yeah.
season.
They're leaning yeah. into their original intention with it.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the intensity, I mean, yeah, in the second season, they clearly ramp it up even higher. But like in the pilot, mm-hmm. there's that showdown scene in the boardroom, that like fishbowl glass enclosed boardroom, typical like broadcast yeah. television room where they're trying to work out yeah. all the details behind the scenes. And the intensity of that conversation is like yeah. bookended by scenes before and after that feel way more sitcom-y.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if half the script was written by one team and half yeah. the script was written by another team and some editor just slapped them together.
Yeah.
It's funny, though, because I will say, again, as like I'm a longtime Sorkin fan in that like I have watched like all of his shows pretty extensively. I'm not always like I'm a fan in that like I enjoy the patter. I don't think all of his stuff works.
Yeah.
I usually enjoy watching it anyway. Like, there's the Sorkin soliloquy, which is just like, you know, the big, long Jeff Winger speech where, like,
yeah.
you know, somebody does it. And then, like, you know, they're making a historical reference to somebody who nobody's ever heard of.
Yes.
And then bringing it back around. And, like, for my pitch, I was, like, really thinking of, like, writing a long, long, drawn out, like, have you ever heard of Stephen Sorkinson, the man who invented the laugh? He invented the laugh? Well,
yeah. I mean,
yeah.
as I always find those entertaining, but when you really sit back and think about them, there are so many logic problems. Like, I like them just because I'm a writer as well. And I like, oh, like, this is a well-constructed story and it ties in
yeah.
all the themes and everything. But at the end of the day, how do all of these individual characters have these stories ready to go? Like offhand, you know, like how do they have these like little anecdotes ready to go
right
at a moment when they need to make a point? Like, it's just crazy.
Yeah.
And I know that I have actually written those into scripts before
yeah.
because I enjoy them. But then I'm like, wait a second, this is serving
me
storytelling and not real life at all.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What writer hasn't had the dream of being Sorkin
yeah.
in the sense
of Sorkining it.
Like, what writer has not ever wanted to just think, I'm going to write the speech that I want to hear, that I
yeah.
wish I could give?
It's a very indulgent, it's definitely a Cameron Crowe thing as well.
Yeah. No, that
it
reminds me of that line from the movie The Wedding Singer, where Adam Sandler is, I think he must have been drunk in this scene, but he's holding the microphone and he's just like, I have the microphone and you will listen to every single word I have to say.
Every goddamn word I have to say. Yeah.
And there were scenes in every Sorkin piece, a lot of which I like, where
yeah.
it feels
yeah.
like that, where it's just
yeah.
like, I have the microphone. So.
Yeah, but it's done so elegantly
yeah.
and so charmingly. Like, that's the undeniable thing about all of his stuff, you know? Like, it's just, mm-hmm. there's an inherent charm there. And, you know, I feel guilty about my initial reactions to the show, as I said earlier, were mm-hmm. super bro-y. But then once you actually settle into the show and hear from the characters, there's more to them and they actually are likable. I just like was kind of annoyed at that first shot of Josh Charles's character where he's like man spreading in shorts. And I was like, oh, I'm out.
Okay.
But then see, I that, was no, back
but
in. The,
but that's a no, but that's a big thing on TV is casters very they don't wear suit pants. Right?
Yeah, so
that
but
that was a behind the scenes thing. Yeah.
I get it. I just didn't like his posture. It was very triggering. He was very manspready and he was very like
I will also add about
too casual.
I'll also add about Josh Charles. Whenever I see that actor in anything, the moment I glimpse his face, I always expect that the kind of character I'm going to get is like his character in Wet Hot American Summer. Like, I'm always just expecting like the double popped collar frat boy type.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it turns out that he's not like that in this show. And he's a much more like
he's very likable,
likable and a nuanced character.
He is. But he's he's delightful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's weird. I've seen it. Josh Charles plays a lot of different types of characters. And I don't think I've ever seen him in something where I actually like liked the character. So I was like very, I was very happy to see this. I was very like, oh, this is good.
He's as close, which is not something you should ever say on a sitcom. He's the closest thing the show has to comic relief.
Like,
like he's the only one there. Him and Josh Molina are the only one there really to make jokes.
Yeah, I was going
to
say Josh Molina too.
Is Josh Molina the guy who played the guy who comes in for the job interview as the associate producer?
I love his speech.
Okay. His speech was great. The one thing I do want to say about it though is that where it's positioned in the episode, especially since it comes after a more dramatic scene, he gives this huge speech. It is pretty funny, but then they give a nice long pause for audience laughter and laugh track to really like let it land. And even his physical posture at the end of delivering the speech is like, he might as well take a bow for the audience. Like, that's how it's done. That's how comedy's done. Like the show really like revels in like, look, we just landed a funny moment.
Yeah. I loved that speech though, too. I was like, I can relate. I need a moment to be analytical. And
I like that too.
I need that 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I like that. Like, you know, at the end of the day, he gets sports. He, you know, he might even sort of like sports, but he's working in television and like he's good. You know, I really like that moment too, because you're like, yeah, not everybody who works on a sports show is a fucking sports fan, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
Cause they're just there to produce a television show.
Yeah.
But I actually, on your point of like the show coming off bro-y, one of the things I took away this time that I'd never really realized, mostly because I was a lot younger then, is that, Casey and Dan are kind of bro-y.
Yeah.
And not kind of, they're bros. They're sports guys.
Yeah.
And like, it's definitely intentional, which I didn't really pick up on before, is that, you're not always supposed to like them. They are kind of douchey at times. Like the line that ends the show, which is really funny, but is also like super bro-y and douchey, is like, you know, when Casey gets over his little thing because, you know, Dan talked him down, but also because, you know, he witnessed something inspiring.
Oh yeah, I know.
And they're like, well, why don't we just go to a bar, find two guys we don't like, and beat them up?
And they're not joking.
They're not joking.
They're not joking.
They're bullies.
It's so weird because then they say things that are like, it's a very bizarre push and pull because they have those bro-y elements, but then they also say things that are witty and charming, and they have certain, you know, idealistic views of things that are kind of inspiring and poetic and things. So it's like a very bizarre.
But there are definitely people who are actually like that.
Who wear
both of those hats.
Of course. Absolutely. I guess.
And so, but you know what? Sorkin does that a lot, and like not always successfully, but like even just like it would be unheard of to even do on TV now. But think about like Jeff Daniels in The Newsroom. Mm-hmm. His character is a staunch Republican. And I mean, he's pretty left leaning for a Republican, but like the show does try to give voices to not just the same
people with nuance.
Yeah. Not just the same white people, but white people of all of different leanings.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could say though about Sorkin that he does tend to write characters that are more nuanced than a lot of other similar shows, where you have here's the conservative character and here's the liberal character. And here's, you know, what you're going to expect out of their behavior. and he tends to write people who, in that regard at least, are more complex.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the episode we watched in season two with Macy, I came close to choosing the episode before where he's introduced, but it ultimately it didn't work as well as the third one. That's why we chose it. But like, he comes off, he is very unlikable.
Yeah, it's obviously that they don't like him at the beginning of the episode.
And in the in that episode, he's more likable to the audience.
Right.
A little. Right. But I find it interesting that, yeah, like he has a lot of characters who are just outright assholes.
Yeah.
But they move the plot. And yeah, he allows them insight as well.
Yeah. I mean, on the topic of that episode, I really hated the moments when he was trying to get the women on staff to whisper the lines into the ears of
that was rough.
The two anchors. And then he takes the step of actually taking away the teleprompter so that they have to do it against their own wishes. I was really pissed off.
Can you not see some fucking white, rich, entitled asshole
doing
that shit?
Yeah, totally. Yep. It is a thing. It's no less hateable, but it is a thing.
The tricky thing is at the end of the episode, they want us to be a bit more on his side. But after that scene, it was very hard
for me to be on his side
at the like climax of the episode.
Yeah.
Well, trust me, he's way worse in the other episode. He is rough.
Okay.
And he's in multiple episodes and he continues to be pretty rough.
We're neglecting to mention a very key detail, which is the mustache.
The Ned Flanders mustache that he has.
Yeah.
Well, Macy always rocks a nice mustache. Whenever he decides to pull it out, it's a welcome addition.
It's intense though. It is it has its own personality. Like it is. Yeah.
It's almost expected to say when you're talking about a show that Sorkin wrote that there's a lot of dialogue and it comes at you fast. And I expect that going into it. But I would say at least for the first 5 minutes of the pilot, it was even faster than I was expecting it could be, to the point where I could barely even follow what was going on. Like it was just hitting me like a windstorm.
Yeah. He's condensing 40 minutes of dialogue into 22 minutes.
You have to really pay attention. And
that's what it is. It's a full hour long drama just sped up.
Oh my God. Yeah. So funny. Yeah. But the shows themselves, like the episodes themselves, really flew by. Like they hit you like a truck and then they're done. And it's, I don't know.
It's an easy watch.
It is an easy watch.
Very, very, very easy watch.
If you're a writer, probably.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just to jump in on another thing here, Barry, a question I had for you was, did you also choose the second episode based on all the talk of network notes and that being a major theme? And the network meddling in the show? Was that like a major reason you chose it?
It was actually. Yeah. In fact, that was I was like, oh, I remember there's this one episode in the second season where they climb up on a soapbox to basically talk about how they're being meddled with.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, well, clearly this is so like transparently freaking meta commentary. I was like, okay, what else are you gonna say? Like, what other messaging are you gonna put out there, Sorkin? Like, it was a very indulgent episode, but it was still enjoyable nonetheless. Like,
Sorkin indulgent?
Exactly. But I thought a little bit of it was like, oh, this is his fantasy. This is what he wants to say to the executives, but can't actually do. Like, it was pretty funny. And like the executives themselves,
they're
like,
so spineless.
Yeah, they're spineless and they're just, you know, they don't have anything of value to add.
The executives
they give them no redeeping quotes.
None whatsoever. None of them have any good ideas. All they talk about is sales, you know. Yeah.
But in a very generic way.
Yeah.
Like the executives, it's expected that they're going to be positioned as the bad guys or as the antagonists.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how thin they are, and it to the point where it feels deliberate. Like, not they're accidentally two-dimensional characters, but they are very deliberately rolling in with like, we're going to get our way because.
Yeah.
It's like, well, what exactly do you want us to do? I don't know. Just not what you're doing.
And,
I don't know why like, I didn't enjoy this in an enjoyable way, but I was just like, in what world are you allowed to threaten network executives with violence on a continuous basis? Like, the first time, they're like, okay, maybe we should fire this guy. Because he's really belligerent. But then by the second season, it's like, nah, they're just like, fuck you, we'll come at you. And you're like, well, they do own the show.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, at the end of the day, they are your bosses who pay all of your salaries, and you're threatening them with physical violence.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I highly doubt, like, Aaron Sorkin was just like, and if you come in here and tell me you gotta put on more laugh track, I'm gonna stand on your throat. Like, no, he was like, interesting. Okay, yeah, we'll see if we can make it work, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, it's clearly just his, like, fantasy of what he would do if he had the opportunity. Earlier, you mentioned, Barry, that episode is meant to make the audience come around to Bill Macy's character more.
Bill Macy?
Bill Macy, yeah.
Yes, without the characters coming around.
Exactly.
The audience, the characters don't know that he stood up for them, which, I, you know, that's fun, dramatic.
It is. I do enjoy that little trope. But yeah, I really liked the way they achieved that. And they achieved that through a very typical Aaron Sorkin walk and talk. Where it was so good. I actually really thought it was well done, where he walks them through the studio. Yeah. He takes the three executives on a little tour of the studio, and you don't know where it's leaving. He's just like, you know, come for a walk with me. We're going to have this conversation while we walk.
And tells them the long story.
Yeah, he tells them the story, the anecdote, as I mentioned, this implausible anecdote that he had off the top of his head about the man who invented television and, you know.
the guy who pitched making the cathode ray tubes by becoming a glass blower. Like, obtuse stuff.
Yeah, and so he ends it with, you know, I want to be the guy that makes the tubes. And so it's like this whole grandstanding thing. And the end of the conversation, they're like, okay, well, now what? Like, where are you taking us? He's like, this is the exit. You can go.
Meeting's over.
Yeah. So I thought it was really well done. It was very clever. But it was an indulgent moment where he was defining his style, where Sorkin was defining his style.
And the one thing I want to add about that on the topic of the walk and talks in general is that in the pilot episode, we immediately see that he's doing the walk and talks in the season.
Second scene is a walk and talk.
By season 2, episode 3, Sorkin's gone from the walk and talks to the hushed walk and talks.
Oh yeah, there's hushed.
We have the scene where we happen to be watching that episode together, and Bryn's like, "You got to turn up the volume. I can't hear it." And then I realized, like, yeah, these guys are talking in a really hushed way, and you do not do that in a sitcom.
No. In fact, that's a big thing with the show in general. Like, a lot of how it's done is just not how you do things in a sitcom.
No,
like, Peter Krause, especially in the pilot, but, like, in general, he is, like I said earlier, he is so intense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's a firecracker waiting to go off. He's not there to deliver sitcom jokes.
Yeah.
Like, No,
none of it. And even, you know, even the speech we talked about earlier, Josh Molina's speech, it wasn't shot like it would be shot in a sitcom. It wasn't a wide shot. Like, it was a weird medium shot.
Comedy happens in the wide shot. It's rare in a sitcom to see anything closer than a waist up shot. And yet this show, like, lives in that space where we're seeing the furrow of the brow.
Yeah.
But Oh, that's a good line. Did you have that written down?
No, I didn't.
I was like, oh, that's good.
On the topic of comedy moments that didn't land, let's talk about the bagel scene.
Oh.
Can't you pick? Okay, so just in a, they're having a really tense meeting, and they're, you know, a bunch of them are about to lose their jobs. And then somebody brings up a memo from catering that says the table's wobbly, and it's supposed to be this big moment that alleviates the tension in the room, and they all start laughing in the most, like, contrived way ever.
It was, like, so drawn out and, like, didn't have any pop to it whatsoever.
And it could have worked.
It could have worked, yeah.
Like, it could have worked, but they all, like,
but they, it was like,
they paused to take a Dr. Evil laugh.
Yeah. Oh, it was so awkward. It was painful. It was delivered much like it would be in a stage play, if you think about it. It's just like, oh, this is the clever moment in the stage play. It was not written at all like a sitcom moment. It should have been something where someone burst in, like some, like, lowly PA burst in and was like, it's an emergency. Yeah. And they're like, what is it? What is it? And then it's like, the bagel cart is, like, wobbly and we're going to lose all the bagels, you know? Like,
and then everyone kind of, has, like, a cathartic moment because it breaks the tension. But, like, it didn't play out that way.
It was so weird. But, I mean, you have to remember at this point, the way Sorkin writes is, he sure has a writer's room, but he sure don't use them. Because he is the credited writer on... So I looked it up. He has solo writing credits on 32 of 45 episodes.
Wow.
But then he has a further 8 teleplay credits, which are solo, but somebody did the story. Wow. So he wrote 40 of 45 episodes.
I mean, that sounds horrifying to me. I would not want that.
And then the West Wing started in the second season.
Yeah.
And he wrote all 22 episodes that season.
That is like anxiety central for me.
You think he just blows out keyboards?
He must. He truly must. You need help when it's something that big, you know, and this is not, you know, I don't have a ton of experience in television, but if I were ever lucky enough to write a television show, I would want help. I would want people stepping in there and being like, hey, you need to like, add in this kind of beat because it's too, you know, it's not moving. It's not, I would want that quote unquote interference. Like, I would not want to be that precious.
Or like,
I'd be precious about the characters, precious about the story world.
Yeah.
But when it comes to constructing several episodes, like, that sounds horrible.
Even if you constructed the plots, you'd at least be like, hey, can you punch this up for me?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, like, he was, I don't know how firm he is in this, but like, he's clearly trying to protect like the Sorkin voice.
Yeah.
Cause a lot of people cannot write like this without it coming off as a parody. Which it often seems to be, even when he is doing it. But like, I have to imagine he writes a little bit like, and I don't mean this in a pretentious way, it has to be like Shakespeare. Shakespeare wrote in iambic pentameter with the, you know, his different rhyming couplets. He wrote that way because it was the only way he knew how to write fast. He could write fast. He could sit down and churn out a play in a weekend, right? That's got to be Sorkin. He sits down.
That's a good point.
Just does it.
Right. And he has a rhythm to the way he does it.
And then how do you rewrite that shit without just being like, well, this scene started 17 pages ago, so I don't really know where to begin on this.
Tonally, this reminded me a bit of some of what we discussed when we were talking about the show after MASH. Like, totally different in every other respect, but just in terms of trying to balance drama and comedy and walking that line in a way that turns out to be pretty awkward in ways where there are definitely moments where it feels like if they just tweaked it a little, maybe this could have worked. Like, it's in range of making it work. But there's ways where there's like one scene that's supposed to be funny and one scene that's really not, and the way they kind of butt up against each other just kind of gets jarring.
Yeah, there's a weird disconnect between the funny and the dramatic, and the show gets better when it stops caring that there's a disconnect, because you feel when the jokes aren't landing.
Shifting topics just slightly, there's the whole story beat at the very beginning in the pilot where it's clear that Casey has lost his kind of love of reporting on sports. And, you know, he gives this whole speech about how, you know, he's sick of reporting on, you know, certain athletes getting, you know, in trouble with the law. And, you know, it's really hard to understand what the commentary is. Is he upset that they're criminals? Because that's what it sounds like. It sounds like he's shaming like athletes with a blanket thing. Or is he upset that the media wants to push those kinds of stories?
Yeah. I took a similar thing. And then when I rewatched it again, I kind of it came a little bit more concrete. He wants to talk about sports. He's tired of talking about the drama and the personal lives of these athletes,
yeah,
especially when it involves them being violent.
Right.
He wants to talk about sports again. He doesn't. And that's why, and he brings up OJ, where he's like,
yeah,
clearly he would have covered a lot of that on whatever show he was on at the time. And that's not what a sportscaster should be talking about.
Yeah.
Right. These are things Sorkin come bring, like, actually, like the violence in the sports media in general is something Sportsnet covers a lot of.
Sure.
And,
I just think that the way they wrote that speech was a little messy. Because it could be so easily taken the wrong way. It could be so easily taken as...
all athletes are...
yeah, exactly. Like, he's making a statement about athletes. Mm-hmm. And he references OJ. And by that time, it's 1998. So it's several years later. So it's kind of like there's been these sad, like, these issues for a very long time. And you're only now getting... sick of it? I don't know. It's just, it's weird. It's like, choose not to focus on those things. Like, unless...
but he doesn't get to.
I know, but make the point of saying that the network is making you do it. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I think was missing there.
Maybe,
you know, it wasn't clear enough. I just thought it was very messy.
Completely messy. But he comes around because he gets to cover, he gets to cover something that's sports.
Exactly.
And he gets very excited
about it. Which was satisfying.
And the rest of the episode, he's talking about how, like, they're trying to get an interview with the guy who beat the shit out of somebody at a strip club.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree that it was messy the way it was executed. And it is a nice payoff, the kind of feel good overcoming obstacles story where the episode eventually leads, that kind of brings him back to getting to talk about sports, but it's also a specific story of an athlete who faced horrible violence and discrimination and then manages to have this huge triumphant comeback, and it's happening live. But it also felt to me a little weird plot-wise as this sort of deus ex machina that saves the character. Because when he's giving the speech at the earlier in the episode and complaining about having to report on these aspects of the athletes' lives and wanting to just talk about the sports, in addition to it being messy tonally, like, what are they trying to say about sports or what are they trying to say about the media? There's also the aspect to me where it was like, this guy has supposedly been doing this show for a couple years now. Why is now the moment where this is bothering him? I find it hard to believe that this has changed drastically.
His life is torpedoing, right?
Yeah. Like, I mean, they make the implication that there's other things in his personal life that are on the rocks. And so that's affecting his emotional state. But it is just weird for him to be talking about it as if, like, now reporting on sports means talking about all this other stuff. And it's like, are you saying that 2 years ago that wasn't the case? I don't buy it.
Yeah.
And then the fact that you get to report on one feel-good story, suddenly everything's fine.
Yeah.
This will generally be his character's arc throughout the show. But it also comes from Sorkin is writing about sports but not caring about sports, just like Sorkin is writing about the behind the scenes of Saturday Night Live without actually giving a shit about Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Right? Like, The Newsroom was intentionally set about a year prior because he was like, oh, let's just talk about the real news. He didn't really care. He's just trying to, these characters are all just mouthpieces for this.
That's a really interesting point. I hadn't thought of that.
I don't know if Sorkin likes sports, but I never got the impression that he did.
It's an interesting question though, because when you proposed doing this show, my first thought was like, yeah, of course I want to see this because it's Sorkin and I'm super curious to see his first show. But I don't normally I'm not that into sports, and a show that's a lot of the most extreme inside baseball of how sports is broadcast is not a premise I'd ever be in for, although with the caveat that I loved the sitcom The League. And so I thought, well, I should give it a chance because, you know, I'm not into football or fantasy football, but I loved that show. And so there's a definite possibility that this will work for someone who doesn't love sports, but it hadn't occurred to me that maybe Sorkin doesn't love sports.
Yeah.
That's funny.
He wrote Moneyball too.
Right.
So maybe he does, but even Moneyball doesn't seem to be overly concerned with sports.
Since we only watched two episodes, we didn't get really the full sense of Felicity Huffman's character, Dana. I guess I didn't really fully understand what was driving her and what her deal was. Like, in both episodes, she was clearly quite stressed and, like, having to, you know, pull everything together and just an overworked, your typical tropey producer. Obviously, there's a bit of a thing between her and Casey. There's, like, a will they or won't they kind of deal. But, like, where does that go, Barry? Like, what? What is the deal with her?
Yeah, most of the show, her character arc is mostly about her career aspirations. She's a very powerful woman who, yeah, it's very tropey, who does not have a lot of time for life in general.
So it's a bit two-dimensional, is what you're saying.
It is and it isn't. It isn't in that, like, every character on the show is exactly the same way.
Sure.
And, like, they all find ways to live through each other. But, yeah, I mean, it's not like we haven't seen her character. She's not far removed from, say, Allison Janney's character on
The West Wing.
That, like, her job is definitely, it is her life, basically, right? But,
yeah,
I feel like... Yeah. Unfortunately, in that position, it becomes your life. Like, it would have to.
Sure. Didn't love the moment in the pilot where Casey kisses her on the cheek very intimately. I thought that
you know
showed
why?
A lack
yeah, that was
of boundaries.
Weird. Yeah.
You know why? He's too intense for it.
He's way too intense. Yeah. It would have that whole moment showing that they might have a thing with each other would have been achieved by a simple, intense look and an emotional reaction to that look.
It's something about his intensity, the hand on the head, the kiss, the
hand.
Hug, the whole
the
thing.
Hand on the head.
And at this point,
the bedroom eyes.
Yeah. There wasn't.
I wish Peter Krause would look at me like that.
Yeah.
Sorry, Aaron.
That's how he looks. That's how he looks at every character. He looks at Josh Charles the same way.
Yeah. That's true.
Just smoldering intensity. Like you don't know whether he's going to punch him or fuck him.
There was just no scene that preceded that one that set up that there could be a will they or won't they.
Yeah.
Luckily, in season 2, episode 3, we see that there is a real, like, romance building between the two of them. And so in retrospect, that scene in the pilot isn't as weird.
Yeah.
But at the time when we were just watching it,
we're like, what
was
the fuck?
No,
there's
no
inappropriate.
Did not ease into this.
No. There were no signs of it before that. Yeah.
A hug would have been fine. And I also don't think that, like, I don't think the moment called for it either.
No. It was, again, it was just more awkwardly executed moment.
Like, the moment, like, in a regular workplace, you know, if you had a really tough thing, you might hug your boss. And that would be a nice moment. But, you don't kiss them on the cheek, and you don't grab their other cheek and stare them in the eyes when you do it.
Yeah.
You just don't.
This was an intense moment.
You don't do it.
Speaking of intensity, everyone in this show is always at their emotional breaking point. Like, every character is either yelling or about to yell.
Yes.
And that's kind of separate from the issue of, is this a sitcom or is this a drama? Because I think you actually could play that for laughs if you chose to. So that's kind of neither here nor there in terms of, like, the genre of the show. But it's just amazing how the intensity is just ratcheted up so tight from the get-go.
11.
Yeah.
Always.
And then it's 11 in the pilot, and it's 12 in season 2.
Yeah.
agreed. I don't know why this really popped into my head, but I just remember, I was trying to remember what Felicity Huffman's character got up to, and then I remembered a lot of it is her relationship struggles and whether she can have it all. But then there's also,
brutal.
I realized that a big thoroughfare is her mentoring the other woman character,
right.
And trying to help the other one with her career.
Well,
that's good
value.
Then.
Yeah.
One last thing I wanted to say about the power positions of these characters, because when you two were talking about her character, it got me thinking about how another thing that was a little hard to interpret in this show is that there seem to be multiple characters who are in some sort of position of authority and who are taking ownership of this show. And it's almost like you'd expect there to be, you know, the the producers or the hosts who have their viewpoint. And then there's the network executive or the other person who has their view on how things should be done. But it felt like every character mm-hmm. was the person who's like, this is my show and it's going to be my way or I'll destroy all of you. And then the other person's like, well, this is my show and I will kick you in the face if I don't get my way. This other person's like, I will walk this minute if this isn't going to be. And it's everyone's show. Who has the most power here?
Yeah.
There's the guy, what is he?
It is a blur.
There's her, Felicity Huffman's character. Yeah. There's the managing editor. There's the network executives.
By the way.
There's the hosts.
Shout out to the managing editor, Isaac. I really enjoyed his character.
Yeah, they should have used way more of him.
So we don't get a lot of him in these episodes, but Robert Guillaume is fucking delightful on the show. And he
great.
Really ends up, he steals every scene that he's in.
Yeah. He's a no bullshit boss.
Yeah, I like that. I really like that line where they're defending firing Casey. He's like, Dana, you got to make the call because I don't want to make the call because that's the thing. It can't be them that makes the call and or whatever it is.
It was a good line.
I just love that because, it's all about maintaining power in these production environments, which is like, there's an associate producer who's like on a television show. No, like when you work on a set, you see the line producer and the associate producer and they all are having these intense days always. So it's like weird to see that reflected on television.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is an honest question. I'm not being sarcastic. I'm honestly asking because you're both troves of knowledge in this area. Has there ever been a show about the making of TV that does not feature network execs who only care about ratings versus producers who are supposedly the ones with integrity? Is there a show like this that does not have that dynamic?
Not to my knowledge.
No.
They're always the villains. The network executives are always the villains. Always the antagonists. Yeah. Maybe not the villains, but antagonists.
As funny as it is, 30 Rock?
Yeah.
I mean, he's...
Well, like, Jack get mess things up for Liz all the time, but...
But usually, he's always on their side after the pilot.
Yeah, it's true. He works with them a lot.
That might be the only one.
He defends them a lot.
Yeah.
It's almost a studio note where you're like, you need to stop bad-mouthing the network.
Yeah.
That's a good, yes. I'll buy that. 30 Rock. Okay.
There's never been a network executive that cared as much as Jack Donaghy.
And one little tiny thing in that second episode that we watched, one of the smaller roles that was one of the team of network executives that are waltzing through the place.
Caught it too.
Played by Tim DeKay, Bizarro Jerry.
Yep, I caught that too.
Just couldn't look at him and not be like.
He didn't really say anything and I kept waiting for him to say something. And I was just like, you're just there for the, just there.
Does he say hello when he leaves?
One thing I was curious about from you guys is that, because I don't know what to make of it most of the time. I guess I don't mind it, but the music by Sorkin mainstay W.G. Snuffy Walden is, he did this and Studio 60 and The West Wing. I never know what to make of this music. I mean, it's weird, right?
Yeah, it is weird.
Okay.
It's definitely, it's bizarre. It seems older than 1998. It seems like this weird tinny 80s music or something. It's not well.
It's like the score produced. I expect from early Law and Order episodes.
Yeah.
Almost a late 80s, early 90s police procedural type of world. There is a weird tinge to it.
Yeah. And it's funny because the other shows, the music fits very well, but this stuff, it just feels very is this a studio note where they were make it a little hipper,
The audio of this show is jarring because the music pulls it more toward drama and the laugh track pulls it more toward comedy.
A lot of guitar riffs.
Yeah. So many. Yeah.
So, Bryn, I think it's that time again for a little 6 Degrees of Friends.
All right, let's do this. As I suspected, there's plenty of connections to be had between Sports Night and the iconic sitcom Friends. Specifically, I found two significant 2 degrees separations. Firstly, Sports Night is connected to the iconic sitcom Friends by 3 degrees.
Oh.
Yeah. It goes like this. Peter Krause, who of course plays Casey McCall in Sports Night, had a reoccurring role on the sitcom Sybil. That one's nice. For you, Aaron. Sybil co-starred Dee Dee Pfeiffer, and Dee Dee Pfeiffer guest starred on Friends.
Hey, how about that?
The next 2 degree connection is just through Aaron Sorkin himself. Aaron Sorkin created Sports Night, as you know, and then he went on to create Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which starred Matthew Perry. And of course, Matthew Perry is Chandler Bing on Friends. And when I was in the middle of doing my research for 6 degrees of Friends...
Could those shows be any more closely connected?
Anyway, in the middle of my rabbit hole of doing the research on 6 degrees of Friends, I discovered that Josh Charles actually co-starred in a short-lived 2007 series that was called 6 degrees. That is literally about the connections that people have to each other. And I went down a rabbit hole connecting 6 degrees to Friends by 6 degrees.
That is amazing.
So if you want to hear it, here it goes.
I do want to hear it.
Yeah. So obviously we will never cover this show 6 degrees because it was from 2007. So it's out of our range. But I just couldn't resist talking about it here. It's a J.J. Abrams show. I won't get into what it's fully about, but it's literally about this phenomenon of people being connected to each other. So it's connected to Friends by 6 degrees through, firstly, Erica Christensen. Erica Christensen was one of the stars of 6 degrees. She was also a reoccurring guest star on Third Rock from the Sun, which starred French Stewart. French Stewart was on Caroline in the City, which co-starred Amy Peetz. Amy Peetz co-starred on a sitcom called Muscle with an actor named Shannon Kenny. Shannon Kenny guest starred on Almost Perfect, which starred Nancy Travis. Nancy Travis guest starred on, can you guess, Aaron?
Sybil.
Which co-starred Dee Dee Pfeiffer, and Dee Dee Pfeiffer was a guest star on Friends.
Bravo.
I can do it in three.
I know you can, but I specifically...
Oh.
I specifically looked for a 6 degree connection because it's 6 degrees. So I wanted 6 degrees of 6 degrees.
Spinoff?
Yeah, so just like 6 degrees of Friends, this is pretty straightforward. All of the stars of Sports Night, Peter Krause, Josh Charles, Felicity Huffman, Sabrina Lloyd, Josh Molina, and of course, William H. Macy, all continue to act and have had a lot of success over the years in several TV shows and movies. Peter Krause, to me, will always be Nate Fisher from 6 Feet Under. Felicity Huffman has made the news for some bad reasons in recent years, but I'll just say for the record, I think it's unfair that William H. Macy doesn't get any flack for that whole scandal. I'd also like to mention Robert Guillaume, who played the amazing boss Isaac, found a lot of success later in his career as a voice actor, but sadly passed away in 2017.
Do you guys know who Robert Guillaume played? Rafiki.
Oh, yeah, he was Rafiki. And he voiced Rafiki in several different Lion King things. Aaron Sorkin, of course, went on to do The West Wing, which was his breakout success on TV. He is now responsible for some of the most critically acclaimed TV in recent years, as well as many other acclaimed feature films. Most recently, The Trial of the Chicago 7, which is excellent.
I really enjoyed that film.
Yeah, I like that movie a lot. And he's got an Oscar, too.
Yeah. Aaron Sorkin is also, of course, responsible for establishing several tropes of his own work, including the walk and talk and quick fire dialogue.
Oh, yeah. Sorkin speak and Sorkin soliloquy. Those are the two Sorkin ones.
Can either of you think of any other tropes that have been highlighted in this show that we haven't talked about before that are not things that Sorkin is known for?
Powerful woman boss trying to have it all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, the will they, won't they?
Will they or won't they?
The will they or won't they? Yeah. I mean, this might be our first will they or won't they, mostly because every other show we've covered, nobody gave a shit.
Is this our first will they or won't they?
I think it is.
Wow. Yeah, okay.
I think so.
Well, then it's a good thing we noted that one. Barry, I'm a network executive, hopefully more three-dimensional than the ones featured in this show, and you are a TV producer. Pitch me Sports Night.
Hey, Aaron.
Mr. Producer.
Walk with me for a second.
Where?
Doesn't matter.
It's just my office isn't that big and...
Have you heard about this Sorkin kid everyone's loving in Hollywood these days?
I think he's like 40.
The little rascal's taking Hollywood by storm. He's got this idea for a sitcom. It's called Sports Night.
Okay, what's it about?
It's about the behind-the-scenes goings-on of a nightly cable news show. The crew works hard and they play hard. We follow their wacky hijinks, relationship woes, and ethical dilemmas as they race against the clock to produce the show.
Oh yeah, I can see that being funny.
Funny? Who said anything about funny?
I mean, it's a sitcom, so it should probably be funny, right?
Let me get back to you on that one.
Woo! This was fun. We've had a lot of laughs, but some things are no laughing matter. What did we all learn from Sports Night?
We learned that rapid fire walk and talks and laugh tracks just don't mix.
Thanks for listening to That Was a Show on Radio Gizmo. This is Bryn Burney,
Aaron Yeager,
and Andrew Helmer as Barry.
Signing off.
And cut to credits. That Was a Show is a production of Radio Gizmo. Subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and follow us on Instagram for info about upcoming episodes. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends about it.
Next time on That Was a Show.
This is not the show I thought I remembered at all. At all, at all.
Finally, a story about the real heroes of the world. A story just begging to be told. The question on every wide-eyed child's mind. What's up with the guy who manages the bus station?
My first impressions were not that deep. They were literally just, yeah, they're really trying to make this gritty, aren't they?
It was gritty. It was gritty, all right. That's for sure.